This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Tensions with North Korea are ramping up. A failed missile test this last weekend might have caused some celebration among the free nations of the world, but the threat from this communist nation is far from over. We're going to talk to trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about what's happening over there, how serious a threat North Korea actually poses, why the Trump administration is getting more deeply involved than it expected to, and a bit on just how difficult a real solution to this problem is. This past Sunday, Turkey held a referendum that expanded the powers of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal is going to bring us up to speed on just what his new powers are, why Turkish voters asked for this, and what this is going to do to relations with Europe, among other matters. America is back. That's what some commentators are saying after recent displays of force by the Trump administration. We're going to talk with trumpet writer Andrew Miller to put these attacks in context, particularly in light of an important forecast that Herbert W. Armstrong made about 60 years ago. And I'll conclude the program by talking about a stranger in your home that you need to be vigilant about. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. This past Sunday, North Korea tested a dangerous new missile, and it fizzled in what was widely seen as a major embarrassment for the nation's dictator, Kim Jong-un. But a North Korean official has said that his nation is going to continue to test missiles regularly, and they're ready to go to war if the United States interferes. In a recent military parade, there was an astounding scale of missiles on display. There's just a whole lot of signs coming out of North Korea that the threat from that nation is great. And we're going to talk about this with our Asia analyst, trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
So is the North Korean threat actually increasing?
I think that we can say that the threat is measurably increasing. The regime is more and more anxious to establish itself as a nuclear power. They feel that, I really think this is beyond saber rattling. They feel that having nuclear weapons is a matter of survival for their regime. Kim Jong-un, the leader in North Korea, knows that were he to go to war in a symmetrical way with the U.S., Japan, and South Korea, which is, you know, that looks like that would be sort of the force against him, he would never be able to match that ship for ship, gun for gun. And so he feels that the only possible way to avoid that is to have a legitimate nuclear deterrent. And so he feels like he has to keep on developing not only nuclear weapons, but also missiles that would allow him to deliver those weapons with precision and even all the way to the United States. And so he feels that he has to keep on and on testing these missiles and testing nuclear weapons in order to develop a legitimate deterrent. And so every time that happens, the United States and South Korea and everyone else go into a full-blown panic, and I think legitimately, just because this regime has proven itself to be so unstable, so thin-skinned, so it's just a basket case regime there. And so it's a recipe that just keeps on and on escalating and escalating, and I don't see how it could really be reversed. So I think we could definitely say that the threat is increasing.
Can you just catch us up to speed on what North Korea's capabilities are? Obviously, it has a very advanced missile development program. It has a nuclear program and is a known nuclear power. And the idea is that these missiles that it's developing, these are intended to be able to carry these nuclear warheads. North Korea has been talking about having a missile that would actually be able to reach the United States. Can you just give us an idea of what its capabilities are at this point and the state of its program?
Sure. Yeah, there are two main components, like you mentioned there. There's the nuclear weaponry, and then there's the missiles to deliver them. So with nuclear weapons, just last year, they, for the very first time, tested a thermonuclear weapon. All their previous tests had been more like the atomic bomb that was dropped on Japan, a much more primitive weapon, much smaller. The atomic bomb is actually used as a fuse, essentially, for a thermonuclear weapon. So they're much more powerful, and they did successfully test one of those last year. However, they do not yet have them miniaturized. So for a thermonuclear weapon to really pose a threat to another nation in a warfare type scenario, it has to be miniaturized enough to be able to be placed on a missile and transported. So that brings us to the missiles. They apparently, North Korea is very close to developing a long range intercontinental ballistic missile. But at this point, they've never tested one of those. They've said that this will be the year that they test the first one, and President Trump has said he's not even going to allow the test to happen. But they have successfully tested short and medium and intermediate ranged ICBMs. So, and some of those tests have failed, some have been successful, but it does show that the missile program is advancing right in lockstep with the nuclear program. So it's the threat really is becoming, you know, more dangerous in both the nuclear capability and the missile capability.
And there are some people who, looking at what happened this last Sunday, as much as people want to belittle this and laugh at a failed missile test, they say this actually makes Kim Jong-un more dangerous. What happens if you embarrass such an unstable man?
That's an excellent point. I think every time one of these tests fails, he, you know, takes it as a sort of a personal affront. He's quite embarrassed by it, and his ego is probably not the most the most robust. He's a very thin-skinned man, and each one of these things, I believe, makes him want to just jump back into his illegal development of all these weapons with renewed zeal and with redoubled effort. So yeah, it's easy for us to sort of laugh and say, oh, that one fizzled out. But all that does is just sort of stoke the fires of his desire to really fortify their programs.
So there were reports that the reason that the missile fizzled was actual deliberate sabotage, and that the United States may have been involved in that. Maybe you could just tell us about that.
Yeah, it's unconfirmed, but I think it's very likely that United States cyber warriors were really the reason for the failed launch. There was a recent report in the New York Times that just kind of uncovered a secret operation to derail North Korea's nuclear missile program in a way that was similar to what the U.S. did with Iran five or six years ago with the Stuxnet program, I think it was. It's a little bit different with North Korea because all of their internal networks are fiercely insulated and they're not connected to the internet in any way. So that poses some real challenges for hackers. But there are cybersecurity experts who say that hacking does not require computers to be connected to the internet. There are other ways to infiltrate those kinds of systems. And so this report by the New York Times and just the input from a lot of specialists and experts in this area say that it's very likely that this last failure and a lot of the previous failures have been because of basically U.S. covert sabotaging. One of the numbers that really sort of bolsters that argument is that North Korea's missile infrastructure is based on Soviet-era missiles. And these Soviet-era missiles failed at a rate of 13%. But North Korea's missiles, same technology, are failing at a rate of 88%. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially the same machinery, but, you know, a whopping discrepancy between how many of them actually get off the ground and do what they're supposed to do. So it does suggest that that's beyond just poor workmanship and incompetence from the North Korean military there. There is plenty of that. They're definitely not one of the most advanced militaries, but with a failure rate of 88%, it really looks like it could have been sabotaged.
I would imagine that those technicians who are working on those systems are pretty careful to do their job exactly right, knowing what's at stake. But so U.S. Vice President Mike Pence, he's been visiting the Korean Peninsula this last week. President Trump has obviously been making some strong statements against North Korea, trying to prevent them from making progress with their weapons development. It seems like the U.S. is more involved in this whole situation than what we were expecting from this administration, is it not?
That is definitely the case. I think under the Obama administration, what we saw was a policy of, how did they phrase it, measured patience. And President Trump has come out and said that policy has ended. We're no longer going to be using this policy of patience. And as we talked about on Friday, there has been a carrier group deployed to the Korean Peninsula. And then just today, I believe President Trump dispatched two additional aircraft carriers to kind of reinforce what's already there. And when Vice President Pence was there, he actually stood in the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea. He stood only 100 feet away from armed North Korean soldiers and just said, he reminded them of what just happened with the U.S. and Syria, those airstrikes on the airbase there. He reminded them of what happened in Afghanistan with the largest non-nuclear bomb being dropped. And he said, these are signs of President Trump's resolve. These are signs of the strength of the armed forces of America. And these are signs that we will no longer tolerate, you know, things the way the previous administration had been.
I think it's interesting, and we were talking about the Chinese president's visit to the United States and the conversation that was happening between President Trump and President Xi, and just how different the conversation seems to be going between America and China than what maybe people anticipated with some of the strong statements that President Trump was making on the campaign trail. But it seems like, I just wonder how much is the threat from North Korea affecting the calculus of the United States in dealing with China and realizing that they kind of need to have China as a partner, or at least that would be the ideal.
Yes, I think that one major change that's happening here is that China, as much as they have supported North Korea in the past, I really felt like they would continue to do so, but I feel like the North Koreans have gone off the deep end to such an extent that even their main benefactor, China, who has a lot to benefit from the regime being unstable and being kind of a distraction and just sharing in the Chinese anti-Western, anti-American ideology, as much as China appreciates all that, it's come to a point where even China can no longer stand by. And as we talked about on Friday, I think President Trump was able to offer some sort of geopolitical concessions, perhaps, to get China on side, maybe some economic concessions. He has already said that he will no longer label China a currency manipulator, which was one of his campaign promises. Now he's backed off on that, and I think he tweeted something like, why would I label them a currency manipulator when they've said that they're going to help us solve this North Korean problem? Mm-hmm. So, one other big part of this is that there's a lot of evidence showing that China had been, in a way, grooming Kim Jong-un, his half-brother, who's Kim Jong-nam. They'd been sort of preparing him. He lived outside of North Korea, sometimes in China, sometimes in, I think it was Cambodia. So anyway, China had been kind of keeping him and preparing him in a way so that if they were to take out Kim Jong-un, the current president or supreme leader there in North Korea, then they would have a perfectly good replacement that shared in the family lineage dating back to the founder. And
a certain legitimacy among North Koreans.
Yes. Yeah. So that was a real ace in the hole for the Chinese. But then 6 weeks ago, Kim Jong-un had his half-brother assassinated. So I think that he felt like he was possibly threatened by the possibility mm-hmm. of being replaced by his half-brother. So he took him out with illegal, you know, biological weaponry. Mm-hmm. And that I believe was a bit of a turning point for China. They said, this is a basket case regime that has nothing that it's not willing to do to preserve itself. And so it just seemed like that was a bit of a, just kind of a game changer.
It's such a puzzling situation. What is the solution to this? This ungovernable maniac in charge. You have a people that is deeply impoverished. You can't just eliminate Kim Jong-un and solve the problem just because of it's sort of the cult, the religion that surrounds him personally. That's popping a bubble that you just don't quite know what's going to happen on the other side of that.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's a big part of the reason why China would like to preserve this regime. They know that if Kim Jong-un, it is a very cult of personality type leadership there. If he were taken out, it could lead to a collapse of the entire country, which they feel would send millions of impoverished North Koreans across the border into China. China doesn't want to have to, deal with that. That would be quite an economic strain to take in that many refugees. It would also remove a buffer zone between China and South Korea, where a lot of, 28,000 U.S. troops are stationed. So up until this point, China's been really trying to do all it can to keep that from happening because of that collapse. But yeah, you're exactly right. Where does that leave you? What is the solution? If you did take him out, what would happen? They had sort of the replacement leader in waiting there, but now he's been assassinated. Mm-hmm. Their hope, I think, with his half-brother was that could prevent that collapse. We could replace Kim Jong-un with Kim Jong-nam and then prevent such a collapse of the country from happening. But yeah, at this point, it sort of looks like, what if we even were to come to some sort of peace with North Korea, with Kim Jong-un? What if we were to at least get to a point where war was not imminent? There's still a much bigger question worth asking, which is, would the United States public and even the international community be willing to make peace with a regime that is so horrible? Mm-hmm. That's murdered millions of its people, that has active gulags all over the country, just, causing the most miserable deaths of lots and lots of people that you could imagine. Are we morally okay with actively working with a government like that? So to me, that's like the best case scenario in some ways, is establishing a peace with them. And that's a terrible scenario.
Right. And in some ways, it seems like more immediately that Kim Jong-un isn't interested in doing that whatsoever. And the question of, how do we accommodate him? It seems like he's kind of forcing the issue with some of the moves that he's making that, I don't think President Trump took office with this vendetta that he was really eager to go after North Korea. But you see the threat rising. And just the instability there and the potential for something catastrophic to come from North Korea. And he's having to step up and address this. It seems like we could very easily see that something major happen with that country and just, some kind of resolution that would be maybe even something we wouldn't expect. Well, very interesting to talk with you about this. I really some fascinating information there that you brought to us, Jeremiah. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the situation in North Korea. Watchthetrumpet.com. We're going to keep on top of our coverage of this country and what's happening there. And you can watch for more analysis from Jeremiah and other trumpet writers there. We appreciate your time, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
This past Sunday, Turkey held a national referendum that awarded President Recep Tayyip Erdogan greatly expanded powers. Many observers are saying that this marks the end of Turkey as a democratic state. It also cements the country's transformation from a secular country into effectively a Muslim country. Yesterday on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Richard Palmer talked about the significance of this development. You can go back and listen to his excellent analysis. Today, we're going to talk with Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about this. We have him via Skype from our office in Britain. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
So first, just give us the update. What are the specific powers that Erdogan received in this vote?
Well, it basically transfers the system of government where you have a prime minister and a president. The presidential office was normally a weaker office than even the prime minister, but we've seen Erdogan kind of change that as he became president. Well, now you don't even have a prime minister once this goes into effect. And so that office has been dissolved. So the president then has sole authority in the country. There is still obviously a legislative body, but he is able to dissolve parliament whenever he wants to. He is able to, from now on, dictate who is going to be part of his cabinet, and he's able to dismiss them at a whim as well. That doesn't have to go through any type of parliamentary process. So those executives that are going to help him run the country are directly reporting to him and chosen by him as well, which is another, you know, tactic to ensure that he can that his will is playing out in the future of Turkey. It also allowed underneath this new system him to possibly run for two more terms. There are 5-year terms now for the president of Turkey. And that would give him an election, I guess, in 2019 would be the next time, and then 2024. So he could rule effectively till 2029. And he can also declare state of emergency whenever he wants to as well, without parliamentary approval. And there are a number of other things as well. Basically, a consolidation of power behind one man. Is what this is.
Now, this he was already extremely powerful, and there were a lot of people who criticized him for exercising his power dictatorially in the country. He puts this to a vote to his people. Now, it wasn't this massive victory for him, but it was about as close as you can get, 50-50 for and against. He obviously has some opposition within the country. But assuming this was a legitimate vote, there are some questions about that, I suppose. What does this say? How much does this really represent the genuine desire of the Turkish people for a strong man?
Well, it is when you talk about Turkey, it is very split, as you said, kind of down the middle. It does obviously that more people voted for yes, but I think the margin was somewhere between 1.5 to 3% of those that voted for the expansion of powers for the president. So you do have a situation where Turkey has divided itself, and it's a similar divide that to what you see throughout the West even. Those in the big cities, they all voted no. The four largest cities of Turkey, Istanbul, Ankara, Izmir, and I forget what the fourth is, they all voted against giving him, majority of them voted against giving him more power. Then you obviously had the Kurds in the east. They voted against him nearly up to about 70% of those. But you had many of the communities, the majority of the communities in the country, particularly those in rural areas, that voted to give him more power. You also had those Turks that were voting inside Europe overwhelmingly give him more power, to the tune in Germany, 66% of Turkey's 1.5 million voters. They said, yes, we want more strongmen, a strongman in power of Turkey, somebody that can make decisions fast, quick, and then have the power without the bureaucracy to bring those decisions into effect. So I wouldn't say that everyone in Turkey is happy with this, but he has got the mandate that he needs. And going back 10 years, I doubt you would have had a majority of Turks would have voted for this. It's definitely a response to the climate that exists in the world.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. What is it about what's happening where they feel like this is what we need? We can't, we've got to have a guy in power. He's got to be able to act decisively and quickly. Why?
Well, I think it is actually in part caused by the rising power of other nations, especially Turkey being concerned of Putin's Russia. They see that they have a leader that is able to act extremely decisively. And basically we have Erdogan following in Putin's footsteps in the way that he is trying to maintain power. So you have that threat that they feel like they need to match. But you also have the rising threat of Islamic powers as well. Turkey is seen largely as a moderating power, and you have Islamic nations on the march, particularly Iran in Syria, right below Turkey. And I believe that is a threat that they feel like, well, Iran has their Ayatollah, Syrian's dictator is answering to whatever he wants, and there is power in that. And they want that as well. Plus, you can also see this.
It tells you quite a lot. It's pretty remarkable that if there are Turks looking at Iran and saying, well, this is we need to have something that's more akin to that model, just the seriousness of the times that we're in.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't think there aren't too many people that are looking to Turkey's south as motivation for this decision of the people, but I do think that's a big factor, as well as the anti-Islam sentiment that you see in Europe right now. That's what he campaigned on. Well, he wanted his men to campaign on a few months ago inside Europe, putting this up, this vote as an us against them. Mm-hmm. Look how Christian Europe is speaking up against Islam. There's a nationalism inside Europe, and we need to have a defense against that. So that's how he painted this, and the people came out and voted.
Well, that's really remarkable. Just looking at the fact that we're seeing something that looks more like these two powers pitting against one another, Europe and Turkey. And it was Europe, after this vote, they came out and said that there were evidence of voting irregularities that need to be investigated. I don't imagine we're going to see too much come out of that within Turkey. But how much does this upset Europe, and what does this, where does this take us in terms of the future of EU-Turkish relations?
Well, this definitely does confirm that Turkey is not going to be part of the EU. This idea has been on ice for about 15 years or so, backwards and forwards, and over the last couple of years, it's become even more apparent that they're just totally different. Turkey and Europe, they are different in many ways.
Now, so what's interesting about that, though, I just want to interject that the trumpet has said that all along, based on biblical prophecy, that Turkey is not going to be part of the EU, and yet, also part of that forecast was the idea that Turkey would continue to try, you know, that there would be a desire within Turkey to become a part of the European Union or European unification project. And yet that seems like that's about as dead as you could imagine it to be, which is interesting.
Well, I do feel that you still have people, it is a minority now, that would want to be part of the EU, mainly because of the economic benefits that would entail. But Turkey itself,
not a cultural affinity,
not a cultural affinity for sure. That's the reason we said that they weren't going to be part of the EU is because we know that it is a Christian dominated or Catholic dominated Europe that's going to rise to the surface, and they're not going to have an Islamic nation as part of it. Mm-hmm. And yet they both realize that they need each other. And I think this is Turkey and Europe. They realize that they have mutual interests in some respects, and that while commentators might now think that, you know, it's all over between Turkey and Europe as far as their relationship that relationship isn't going away. NATO, Turkey's a NATO nation. It's got probably the most second largest army in NATO, I believe. It's absolutely massive. If Europe wants an access point to the Middle East, like the Americans, they use Incirlik Air Base. Strategically, Turkey's very important for Europe's platform to get into the Middle East. So there are some
not
mutual
to mention
needs.
The relationship that we've talked about over this past year as using Turkey as some kind of a gatekeeper for immigrants coming into Europe and basically being willing to deal with Erdogan simply for the fact that he's able to restrict the flow of immigration into Europe. And it's quite a bit of leverage that Erdogan has had in dealing with Europe.
Yeah, he's had a lot. And that's, you know, the public inside Europe, I feel many of them don't understand how much that Erdogan is able to hurt Europe in many ways, especially with those migrants. So they are very upset because it looks like Erdogan, this guy in the Middle East, is dictating terms to Europe. And there are the outcry from European officials has been pretty loud over the past couple of days about this wasn't a fair election. They say it might not have been rigged, but the availability for anyone other than the Yes campaign on Turkish television was very minimal. I mean, they flooded the airways. You even had messages coming from the mosques, which I think is interesting. Different imams speaking from the mosques that people needed to go out and vote yes. So they were obviously very supportive of this, the religious segment of Turkey's society. But Europe itself, I think, just realizes strategically that they need to have some type of relationship with Erdogan, even if he is a dictator, even if he is striking down civil liberties, even if he is about to bring back the death penalty, which looks like another referendum is about to be on the table inside Turkey.
Just to go back to your point about the imams, that was actually something that Richard talked quite a bit about how much this represents the rise of religion. You know, in a sense, it really is easy to see Erdogan and the fact that he does represent the rise of this Muslim influence within the country, quite at odds with the secularist approach that was taken before he came on the scene, that this puts Turkey at odds with Europe in a really quite direct way. But the picture in prophecy, if we can just put this to finish in the context of what we know prophetically, it's a little bit more complicated than just a direct Muslim versus Christian type of a situation.
Right. We are looking at looking at Bible prophecy. We do see that Europe is going to be more involved in the Middle East, and the Middle East is full of Muslim nations. And if you look, how are they going to impact the Middle East with their power? They have to have some type of ally. They have to have some type of friend. Obviously, Iran isn't going to be it. We know that in prophecy wise. But looking at the rest of the Islamic states, those that have a majority Muslim population, Turkey still seems like the most moderate of all of those. And so if Europe is going to be more powerful in the Middle East with those other states, they need some nation to help them out. And I feel like Turkey is going to play that role.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Brenton Oktagal about the situation in Turkey and the vote this past weekend to make President Erdogan even more powerful than he already was. Watch for an article about this subject on thetrumpet.com. We'll keep our reportage up on the website about that. And Brent, thank you very much for your time.
No problem.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The last couple of weeks have seen some displays of military force from the United States, missiles launched against the Assad regime in Syria, a massive bomb dropped on an Islamic State stronghold in Afghanistan. To this point, it looks like these two strikes have had some pretty positive results in terms of boosting the credibility of the Trump administration, perhaps strengthening America's negotiating position with other nations, putting America's enemies on notice. It's worth putting these strikes in context, however. Here at the Trumpet, for many years, even decades, we have reiterated a strong forecast that was made by Herbert W. Armstrong just after World War II. It's a regrettable forecast in the sense that we'd rather this were not the case, but it has nevertheless proved true, and we still stand by it. That is Mr. Armstrong's statement that America had won its last war. This is a forecast based on the prophecies of the Bible. And it puts the Trump administration's efforts in the larger context of what the Bible says about America's future. To talk about this, we have Trumpet writer Andrew Miller. Hello, Andrew.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to have you. Let's start by talking about when Mr. Armstrong first made this forecast. America obviously won World War II in 1945, but it wasn't long after that that he began saying this. What was behind it?
Right. Well, it was just coming out of World War II, and obviously that was a huge military victory for the United States and the Allied powers, but it was also a time of a lot of change in America, where a lot of like the traditional family values and moral values from past generations were getting away from. You were moving into like the sexual revolution and moving away from the old standard of where you get married and stay married and have just this nuclear family into all these new values. So that was really Mr. Armstrong's, one of his signature prophecies was warning that you're abandoning the Bible, you're abandoning the Ten Commandments. And there's actually a prophecy in Leviticus where it's called the Blessings and Cursings chapter, where God goes through that. He said, well, if you follow all my laws, these are all the things, all the good things that will happen to you. And if you turn from my laws, these are all the bad things that are going to result from that. And one of the main curses, if you're not actually following those Ten Commandments, is that God says the pride of your power is going to be broken.
And it Leviticus 26, verse 19.
Yeah, Leviticus 26, verse 19, where it talks about, it says, I will break the pride of your power. And so Mr. Armstrong, looking at the society around him and noticing all these societal changes and getting away from even a very letter of the law understanding of those Ten Commandments, he's saying that, said, well, if God's word is true, that he's going to break the pride of your power and you're not going to be winning any more wars. And he still noted that at the time, and probably still true today, America was by far and large the world's strongest military power, but they didn't have the will to actually use that power anymore because of all these sins within the nation. And so you started seeing like unworld, like World War II, as you're going into he's first started making this prophecy in the 50s, into the Korean War, where they fought for almost the same amount of time they did in World War II. But unlike World War II, where you beat Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan simultaneously in 5 years, Korean War, they fought North Korea, tiny little North Korea, for just for 5 years, ended in a stalemate, and that regime still plaguing us today.
So this is a pretty not a proposition that a whole lot of people would agree with. He's linking military victories with national morality in a way that today a lot of people would probably say it absolutely there's no relationship between these two things. And yet, starting with the Korean War, how has this prophecy proved accurate?
Right, and there's been, even politically, there were some changes there to where World War II was the last war where actually Congress actually declared war. That's something the our founding fathers had put into the Constitution so that presidents couldn't take the nation to war unilaterally. And if Congress did give them war powers, they knew that they had the legislature and the people behind them, so you could go out into like all-out military victories. Now, with the decline of morality and the getting away from this principle of just having what they now call limited war, you have it where you don't have like a full nationalized mobilization. You just have the executive branch of the government doing limited strikes like they did in Korea and like they did in Vietnam, and the nation's not behind them, especially within like Vietnam. You have all like a lot of the same counterculture movement that was triumphing, these new sexual values and this new legalizing of drug usage and all these other vices. They were also protesting any of the war efforts to have it. So you're actually, is almost like a civil war, not a violent one, but like a cultural civil war within the nation itself, to where mm-hmm. you're not actually winning overseas because you don't have the support you had at home back when the nation was more united.
A house divided back home. So you had the Korean War. Obviously, that ended in a stalemate, and that persists to this day. After that, you had Vietnam.
Right, and so, yeah, this Korean War ended in a stalemate. Vietnam actually ended in a, I guess, you'd probably say stalemate at best. Most people would say all-in-out military defeat in that, obviously, within the Korean War, where you still have North Korea and South Korea. There is no South Vietnam anymore. The communist North Vietnam just took over that country. Mm-hmm. And so those are probably the two really non-controversial military losses, as most people say that, okay, Korea was a stalemate, Vietnam was a loss. After Vietnam, all through the Carter years, you had these tensions with Iran and having like some of these, like the Iranian hostage crisis that ended in a debacle there. You got back into the Reagan years, and it looked like you got a little bit more pride in your power back, but it was, again, is just like Band-Aid solutions to things and problems in Latin America. There wasn't actually no full-out war efforts in any of those provinces or countries. And then you finally come to like the first Gulf War, where that's normally the one where if people want to dispute the accuracy of this prophecy that you'd point to, in that
a lot of people would look at 1991 Gulf War, say, well, we did accomplish what we were trying to. Iraq invades Kuwait. The United States goes in there with a large coalition of nations, a whole lot of nations that helped out in that, kicked Iraq out. We won.
Right, and we definitely, even from very early on, this was after this war happened, after the trumpet was already, Philadelphia trumpet was already on the scene, and our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, did admit that, said we won a battle and that we stopped Saddam Hussein from taking over Kuwait, but it definitely did not solve the problem of Saddam Hussein at that point. He was still in power. He was still making all these chemical weapons that he was using against his own people in other theaters. We ended up having to go to war against him again just a handful of years later.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to look at what Gerald Fleury was saying back at that time. And so he said, well, we may have won a battle, but we didn't win the war. It's really easy to see how accurate that was. Right. As we look back at the situation now, I mean, we're talking about the fact that we've been engaged in Iraq ever since then, in a sense that we had to, like you said, we went back in 2003, and then it's just been a quagmire ever since, and we've really turned it over to Iran in a lot of ways. Not exactly a victory.
Right. Like I said, in 1991, it may have been a little easier to construe it that way because they did stop them from taking Kuwait. But then, like I said, fast forward like
12 years later, 20 years.
And then you're right back there dealing with those same dictators, same weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. And then fast forward all those years from then, like I said, we're still in there to this day, still in Afghanistan till this day. They've declared famously under the George W. Bush administration, declaring a war on terrorism, which is about as vague an enemy as you could define. But in all those years since then, and still no closer to actually getting a handle on the threat of Islamic terrorism.
Yeah, I tend to think that, say, those soldiers who have been engaged in war in Iraq, in Afghanistan, would have to look at the situation the way that it is today and acknowledge, you know, again, as regrettable as it is, the accuracy of Mr. Armstrong's statement that America has won its last war. I mean, these wars are going on year after year after year. There's never really any decisive victories. Maybe we'll take this city and we'll have it for a while, but then we pull back and, you know, a short time later, you have enemy forces back in there. There's this sort of back and forth, but nothing decisive. And now we're very war weary, and there's no stomach in the United States for any kind of protracted war or, like you said, a national mobilization in order to do what it would take to really accomplish anything decisive in these theaters. And it's interesting to even just think back to, say, 2003, when the United States went into Iraq. And there really was a massive show of force. You remember shock and awe, George W. Bush saying, you know, we're going to deal with this decisively. And yet, you know, we're here just 49 missiles or whatever it was into Syria, one large bomb in Afghanistan. There are a lot of people who are talking about this as if it's the second coming of America, that we're back on the world scene. It's nothing even compared to Bush 2, Bush 1, Reagan.
Right. Mr. Trump's getting a lot of publicity for just how strong he's been in the response against ISIS and against Assad and against North Korea. And a lot of that is just comparatively due to they were so much weaker during the Obama years. But like I said, even just a short 20 years ago, you had much stronger responses than he's done that did not end up in any great military victory. And that's what some of the columnists, they're just really looking at, like I said, the second coming of America, although there's been there's others with a more historical bent, like Victor David Hansen, who's just kind of saying, like, okay, well, this is definitely showing the world that chemical warfare against your own people is not acceptable, but does America actually have the long-term stomach to follow through with what it started? Mm-hmm. Or is it just going to be, you know, a bomb here, a bomb there to kind of discourage people from doing anything too horrible, and then just kind of hoping that this goes away without just stirring up more problems over there or toppling regimes that lead in for the world's biggest sponsor of terrorism, Iran, to just take over, and then you go out of the frying pan and into the fire type situation.
Yeah, I really do just want to underline and reiterate the fact that this is not a happy thing to forecast by any means. It's a regrettable thing to forecast. But the reason for the forecast is the prophecies of the Bible. Mr. Armstrong, Herbert W. Armstrong, was looking at the moral state of the United States and recognizing how that was going to impact the nation's ability to project its power. It was going to impact the will of the nation in order to project its power globally. And it's a forecast that has proven true. Andrew's written an article for thetrumpet.com. You're going to be able to read this very soon on the website. It's called Why the Trumpet Says America Has Won Its Last War. This is actually one of several articles that we are putting up on the website that are broader explanations of some of the larger points that we have gone back to time and time again in our analysis. It's an excellent article and one that you're really going to want to spend some time bringing. It brings the reader up to speed on just why we've been saying this for so long. Andrew, we appreciate you coming in Really fascinating subject to talk about.
All right, thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
If you came home and you found a strange man teaching your kids to punch each other or trying to sell them all kinds of products, you'd kick him right out of the house. But here you are, you come in and the television is on and you don't think twice about it. Dr. Jerome Singer of Yale University made this wise observation. Do you control the television in your home or does it control you? Almost every U.S. household has at least one, and it's typically on 7 hours a day. The average American adult spends over 1,700 hours a year gazing at it. Millions of Americans are so addicted to TV, they meet the criteria for substance abuse in the official psychiatric manual. Statistically, a young person turning 18 will have spent more hours with this stranger than doing anything else except sleeping. 6 out of 10 children watch it without supervision. 4 out of 10 keep one in their bedroom. What is all this TV doing to us? Well, first, the hours devoted to television can never be reclaimed for something productive. And it's not the most refreshing diversion. After an hour or two of television, people tend to be cranky, irritable, and tired. Research shows that people don't respect themselves for watching television, don't enjoy it much, and by and large, wish they would quit. Does that describe you? Children who watch a lot of TV show a reduced capacity for creative imagination, concentration, and delayed gratification. Images on screen change on average every 4 seconds, shrinking our attention spans and creating deficiencies characteristic of learning disabled children. Then there's the content of the shows. None of us can watch without picking up ideas, values, and patterns of behavior. It shapes our sense of what's normal, what's funny, what's beautiful, what's cool, even what's right and what's wrong. Even children's programming is loaded with depressing and wrong messages, not to mention the fact that 10.5 minutes of every hour are devoted to advertisements for things they probably don't need or that could even be bad for them. On top of that, young people often end up watching adult programs that can feature violence, drunkenness, sexual promiscuity, and other evils. And in effect, our children are eavesdropping on the adult world, picking up lies and faulty behavior as they go. TV portrays a horribly distorted, unhealthy, unrealistic picture of sexuality. It focuses on the perverse and ignores negative consequences of its wrong use. Immorality is made to look normal, with few or no kickbacks. TV also promotes materialism. Among heavy TV users, the feeling is strong that certain material goods are necessities, whereas light TV users usually consider the same goods luxuries. So television can make us dissatisfied with what we have, no matter how much, no matter how lavish. Other common messages on television, pinpointed by media researcher Dr. Robert Kuby, include these. Authority is evil. For everything, there's a quick fix. Young is better. Open and unfilled time is not desirable. In fact, it can't be tolerated. Violence is acceptable. Religion is unacceptable. Michael and Diane Medved's book, Saving Childhood, shows how TV additionally bombards us with messages encouraging impatience, self-pity, insecurity, and pessimism. Then there's the persistent foul language and gross humor, the coarse communication and shameless disrespect, the shallowness and lies mandated by political correctness. Add to these the ways that television trains us to root for the bad guy, to smile at lawbreaking, to cuddle comfortably with compromise as a way of life. What would we do if we caught a school teacher trying to feed these concepts to our children? Now, many people say, I know, it's terrible, isn't it? I can't believe they show that stuff. Yet, so many of us keep watching, convinced that we can handle it, while it gradually sculpts and shapes the way we think, the way our children think, how we behave. What we see on television isn't called programming for nothing. That's not to say there are no positives to television. There are educational programs. It can be relaxing, even bonding, if used judiciously with genuine moderation. But the danger is that we grow comfortable with televised sin after a lifetime of programming. This is an area of family life we cannot be careless about. Don't let this stranger into your home unchecked. Keep a close eye on him. Limit his influence. Don't let your kids spend time with him alone. Scrutinize how he affects you and your family. And if you need to, kick him out. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Jeremiah Jacques, Brent Nachtigall, and Andrew Miller. Also, thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Mark Twain. The best way to cheer yourself up is to cheer someone else up. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.